Today is the 19th of September 2001, and it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to an old friend and colleague, Dr. Mick Allam, who is just on the point of early retirement to write a great work, or another great work. And we're sitting in his room, which is just in the last throes of being clear, and going to go over some of Mick's life and works. So, thank you very much indeed, Mick, for letting me talk to you. Can we start chronologically by your telling us something about your childhood and parentage, what your father and mother did, for instance, and your background?
Well, my father was at Magdalen and did classics, and then he, after a year or two, found himself in the British Museum in the Department of Coins and Medals. And then at the outbreak of war, since the British Museum was part of the civil service, he was moved around and worked in Ministry of Shipping. And after the war, he couldn't afford to go back into academic or museum work, so he was a civil servant a lot of his life, but always retained his scholarly and academic interests and continued to write papers evenings and weekends, and eventually became secretary to the British Academy in succession to Mortimer Wheeler, and finally a treasurer of the British Academy just before he died.
So your academic background was partly, largely influenced by having an academic of a kind as a father.
Yes, I think so. On the other hand, I would also not want to underemphasize the influence of my mother, who, although she never went to university, was always very interested in foreign languages and cultures. She lived in the 30s, first in France and then in Germany during the Nazi period. And she spoke German very fluently, almost married a German. And she encouraged us to be interested in continental travel and languages and so on. And I think she had quite a significant input. She was also a keen mountaineer, which transmitted itself to me. So I went with her on various holidays in North Wales and so on. And this undoubtedly turned my thoughts towards the bigger mountains and ultimately the Himalayas.
And did you have brothers and sisters? Or?
Yes, we were three brothers, no sisters. My middle brother works for the International Standards Organization in Geneva. He edits their bulletin. And the youngest brother is in Luxembourg at the European Investment Bank, where he makes decisions about investing money and that sort of thing.
That suggests that your mother imparted an interest in mid-European languages. So, I mean, did she speak or teach you any French and German when you were young?
She certainly encouraged us to learn them and took us on holidays. Though it wasn't so easy, of course, in the 40s and 50s, because we weren't allowed to take much money abroad. But she sort of took it for granted that everyone would learn and be fluent in and have a reasonable accent in these languages. And I think that was quite a significant feature of our upbringing.
Because, in fact, two anthropologists you probably admire most, or two of the anthropologists you admire most, are Mauss and Dumézil. These are Frenchmen, so.
Yes.
Absolutely. For instance, you read French well, obviously, and could appreciate their work in originals. How was it that you went to Hong Kong? Because you've mentioned that.
Well, my father was still working for the Ministry of Shipping, and they sent him to the Far East to write a report on the porting shipping facilities in the Far East for their own purposes. And he took his young family out in 1947, and we had 2 years out there. I have often wondered whether that played any significant part in my becoming an anthropologist, but on the whole I rather doubt it, because it was a very expat environment with servants and very little genuine contact with Chinese culture. I remember it chiefly for the magnificent beaches that surround the island of Hong Kong, and for sort of outdoor activities, walking in the mountains, that sort of thing, and not for anything at all cultural.
Mm. When you went to school, where did you go to school first? Did you go to a boarding school or?
During the war, we sort of moved around, moved out of London, various different kindergartens and schools. Wagner's in Kensington towards the end of the war, a couple of different schools in Hong Kong, and then a prep school in England, in Buckinghamshire, and then I went to Rugby. Where I was for 5 years, 52 to 57.
Often that, maybe the preparatory school, but certainly the next school, has enormous influence on one's subsequent life, sometimes through what one decides to become interested in, and sometimes through a particular teacher or one or two teachers. Was there anyone you remember or any experience?
Oh yes, very much. This was a fairly traditional school in the 1950s, no women of course, no girls, and rather a right-wing conservative sort of environment, but I opted for classics, and they right away sort of pushed potential Oxbridge classicists up through the ranks, and I ended up with more than 2 years in the top form with an extremely good classicist who subsequently published after retirement a number of perfectly respectable classical books in classics. And he used to give us weekly tutorials as schoolboys, just like an Oxbridge tutorial with in his study in his home for an hour a week, going through the proses and verses that we'd been writing. But also he made a big effort to enlarge our intellectual range, encouraging us to take an interest in Italian painting and in music and so on. So I owe a great deal to him.
He encouraged you, I mean, he said you were...
Yes, undoubtedly he... sort of pushed us. He fostered a certain number of us who he thought would get on in academic life.
Did you keep any contact with him afterwards?
I did for a few years, but then he went blind, unfortunately, and died. But I was really quite close to him, and he took us to Italy, and that was a very successful holiday. He also took it for granted that one would learn Italian for that trip, and you know, we didn't look at grammar. It was just taken for granted that if you knew Latin, you moved on to Dante, and we had little reading groups in his back garden reading Dante. Yes, I owe a lot to Saunders. He was called Norman Saunders.
So by the time you were, say, 18, you already spoke Italian. If you can speak Latin, you understood Latin, Greek to a certain extent, German and French and English.
Yes, I'd done a year of Spanish too. The school allowed classicists to do a little bit by way of options, and so I did get a year of Spanish. But virtually no science, amazingly little science, one term on the lower forms of pond life, and I could have got through the whole of my education with no more science than that. Astonishing now.
Indeed. I mentioned the languages because later you were to become very interested in languages and learn them relatively easily. Presumably it helped that you'd already learned so many different...
Yes, I think it did. Yes.
Talking of pond life and science, you then went on to university. Where did you go and what did you read?
Well, after taking a classic scholarship to New College in 1956, it would have been. I came up in 57 to New College, but I decided to change course altogether and read medicine. So the last two terms at school, in fact, I began quickly rushing through O levels and in physics and chemistry and botany and zoology. And in those days, the requirements for entering medical courses were nothing like what they are now. It was regarded as intellectually fairly easy subject to get on in. And so after my first term at Oxford, where there was a bit of extra catching up, I was sort of treated like any other Oxford medic. So it didn't take very long to shift gears.
Why was it that you suddenly made the switch to medicine?
Well, I think it was probably that, although I enjoyed classics, I found that it really was rather a narrow education. And I wondered really what else I might do, and it wasn't very obvious to me what else I might do, but it was clear that you could make a good case for becoming a doctor, whereas you couldn't sort of suddenly decide at the age of 17 that now you were going to become a nuclear physicist or something. So I don't think I was deeply committed to the idea of being a doctor, but I was keen on enlarging my intellectual range and knowing a bit more about the real world.
Your parents didn't put any pressure on you to study?
No, they were extremely, they were entirely permissive, whatever you think is right for you, they were quite happy. I think it was sort of thought during my school days that I'd become a lawyer or perhaps a diplomat, ordinary sort of fates for a classicist in those days. But there was a family precedent. My mother's brother had gone up to Cambridge as a classicist and then had shifted to medicine. So that was also a reason why they weren't perhaps particularly surprised or put off by this change, of course.
Was there any philanthropic motive? I mean, do you feel you might go out and help suffering people?
Yes, I think I thought that perhaps I shall come to feel the desire to do so in due course. Whether I actually did feel that strongly, I'm not quite sure. I think I felt it in a sort of experimental way. It would be rather fun to sort of imagine myself doing a Dr. Schweitzer or something.
At Oxford, again, were there any teachers or experiences that you think had a particularly formative influence on you?
The medical course didn't influence me very much, I think. Certainly not the first couple of years when one's doing anatomy and it's really rather boring. And none of my teachers were particularly inspiring at that stage. But I did have some fellow students, one in particular, who began by dissecting the same arm as I did, and then gradually moved away from medicine into PPP course and
philosophy, politics,
and psychology. And he did quite well at that and eventually ended up as a philosopher of science teaching in Amsterdam. And he always had a very wide range of curiosity and interests. John Dawling, he's retired now, and I probably owe much more to him than to the people who officially taught me. By the fourth year, when I was able to do a year of research, there perhaps I gained a bit more understanding of the nature of scientific work, but I soon realized that I wasn't cut out for it. I did some research in neurophysiology, and we produced a paper, myself and John Nichols, my supervisor, but it wasn't a particularly successful project, and I realized that I wasn't cut out to do experiments. I love knowing about how the brain worked, but the nitty-gritty of doing the experiments with the cathode ray tubes and doing the statistics on the results, all of that was a bore as far as I was concerned. So I was quite happy to leave that.
By the time you had your degree, were you still thinking you'd be a doctor, and what did you go on to do at that point?
Well, at this point I was very uncertain what I was going to do, and I rather drifted, to be honest. Everyone around me expected me to complete the medical course, and although I was by no means sure what I would do with this, I drifted through it. And I'd had not too bad a time in London, but I always felt... St Mary's Hospital in Paddington. I never quite felt that I belonged in that environment, and indeed I spent a lot of the time doing climbing. I'd become quite a keen rock climber at that time, and I also managed to manipulate elective periods and spent a month in Spain and a month in Greece during my medical training. But right until the end of that, I was quite uncertain what to do. And when I got through the medical exams, it was only then that I really came across the idea of anthropology.
Did you practice as a doctor at all?
Oh, yes. I did eventually three house jobs, medicine in Paddington, surgery at Banbury, and which was fun, a psychiatry in Edinburgh with... Carruthers, was it? What was the man who worked on? Yes. So I did have, and four or five locums too, so I had a certain amount of hospital experience, no GP experience whatsoever, and in those days there was, the medical course included no training in GP medicine, so that when I found myself in the field in Nepal, my medical training was really of very little use because it was so oriented to work in a hospital with path labs and nurses and other assistants to help one.
But all the time you were feeling this wasn't right. and you say suddenly or somehow you then came across anthropology as a topic.
I stumbled across Haddon's book on the history of anthropology on the bookshelves of Alfie Gell's father, who was in fact the mother's brother I mentioned earlier. And I picked it up without any sort of particular sense of discovery. And reading it, I realized that there existed this whole subject of anthropology.
Did you then follow it up by further reading or meeting an anthropologist, or what happened then?
I think I probably read the Teach Yourself Anthropology book. And
what year is this?
We're now talking of about 64, I should think. And then I came to see Godfrey Linhart, who must have been admissions officer here at Oxford. And I think he was the first anthropologist I'd met or spoken to, as far as I remember.
Let's have our reminiscences about Godfrey then, perhaps. Either then or later as a colleague of yours.
Yes, that meeting is really way back in the mists of the past, but I came to know him quite well at Wolfson, and I gained great respect for him. He was a marvellous man in many ways, very intelligent. Not, it has to be said, very industrious as an academic, but very sharp in his judgments of people, and a very good friend to those he liked. He was always sending people postcards and giving evidence of the fact that he was thinking about them. Very thoughtful, considerate to people when he chose to be. He could also be quite vicious when he chose to be too.
Yes. This is what Peter said as well. How would you rate him as an anthropologist? Some people say that his His certainly his one book on Inca religion is one of the great accounts of.
Yes, it's a good book, but as I'm not an Africanist, I have not made a great deal of use of it in my time. I always respected his book introducing anthropology, just called Social Anthropology, although I didn't always agree with it. It's one that I for a long time set to students as a very intelligent and nicely brief and well-written account of the subject. Of
a
course,
very
it's
humane and humanist. Book,
very much, yes.
Who are minor philosophers and so
yes.
on.
Interesting. Yes, and I liked the way that he referred, for instance, to the odd Russian anthropologist and so on.
Was he a good teacher, do you think, either as a PhD supervisor or lecturer?
I would say he was at his best as a supervisor in terms of encouraging people and bringing out their sensitivity and their humane breadth of understanding. He, of course, he didn't read a great deal of anthropology, and he's not the man you would turn to for the latest references on some theoretical issue. So he was good in some respects, and I think he did a lot for the sense of loyalty that people had to the Institute. Of course, in those days there was so much less pressure on time, and people could take their time over a doctorate, and often people were around Oxford for quite a long time, adding a lot of richness to the environment. And he contributed a lot in that sort of social way, rather than perhaps in raising intellectual thoughts or issues. For that, one would look rather to someone like Edwin Ardner.
When you came and saw him, he encouraged you, and then you decided to do a degree in a first degree or a
yes,
master's degree.
Well, in those days it was just called the diploma, but it would now be a one-year master's, which I did with Needham, in fact, Rodney Needham. And he was an inspiring teacher, not altogether an easy person, but I learnt a great deal from him, and it was a marvellous year, really exciting, especially after the slightly routine, slightly dreary nature of a medical course where you don't get many new ideas, you get new facts all the time, but not many new ideas.
So that year was very exciting and
marvellous year, yes, yes.
And Needham at that point, as your supervisor for a one-year diploma, was a very good supervisor. He encouraged you and
yes. He had a real sense of intellectual adventure that he managed to convey, and he wasn't, he had his dislikes and he had his blind areas. There were some areas of the subject that he didn't teach about because he didn't think they were interesting, and as a result I've remained weaker on them ever since, I fear. For instance, he wasn't interested in applied anthropology, he wasn't interested in economics. There were sort of
there were certain people
gaps. Oh yes, yes.
Who in particular? I don't think Jack Goody was high on his list of favourites.
He would not have been high on his list of favourites. No, no. At this time, of course, we got a lot of Levi-Strauss and structuralism because Needham had just been translating. One of totemism, wasn't it? And he was very keen on structuralism. And he was rather rude about Radcliffe Brown. We were not ever encouraged to sort of look at the positive side in the man's contribution. It was always terribly dismissive. Needham went in for black and white judgment. So-and-so was important and worthwhile, and you should read everything by him. So-and-so else was a waste of time.
He was a great fan of Hogarth, wasn't he?
Yes, yes.
And actually, talking of Hogarth, Hogarth must have influenced your work.
Yes, in some ways. I've I like several things about Hocquart. The world historical grasp, which he retained from a much earlier era of anthropology, which I've always felt very important, indeed part of the raison d'etre of anthropology, and it was rather abandoned by the anthropology of the 50s and 60s that was being taught me in lectures. So I admired that aspect of him, and subsequently I found that in a number of more technical things like kinship theory, he had some very good ideas that were way ahead of his time.
Who else was at Oxford during that diploma year? Was Evans Pritchard still professor?
He was, yes, and he was very nice in a personal way to me, very friendly. Used to tease me about you quacks, and sort of pretend that he could cure himself of his arthritis much better with his copper bangles than with any pills that we quacks produced. But I didn't have a great deal to do with him as a teacher, because I wasn't particularly concerned with Africa, and his lectures on the history of the subject were really above my head at that time. I knew too little European intellectual history to give them any context, and so I didn't gain a great deal from them.
Mm. But subsequently you've obviously read and taught Evans Pritchard. Again, are you in a position to rate him as a...
Well, I greatly admire him, certainly, but he represents a rather different sort of anthropology from the sort that I most enjoy. I mean, after all, he is above all a descriptive ethnographer, and brilliant at that. And I regard that as a very important aspect of anthropology, but I'm not a brilliant descriptive ethnographer, and so the sorts of questions I find interesting and want to ask were not really the sorts of questions that he was asking. So I wouldn't say that he'd been a great influence on me.
The other people must have been John Beattie.
Yes. Well, although Needham was very dismissive of him, I found his lectures actually extremely helpful. They were very sane and balanced. And I think that I did learn quite a bit from him. I wouldn't say he was quite so exciting as Needham, but you needed a bit of balance. Yes, you really did, because if you took on board too much Needham, you could really go over the top, I think.
And who else was there? Who was the Indianist?
David Pocock at that time, and I did the option course with him. Mm. He was slightly fearsome character in my mind. I mean, he had a slightly peppery manner, and was apt to, if you knew nothing about the subject, regard you as rather stupid. Mm. And but of course, he was a competent and good teacher, and one learned quite a lot. And of course, he'd been in close contact with Dumont, and that was subsequently to be quite important, I suppose, to me.
So the link with French anthropology was quite strong at that time, both with Dumont.
Yes.
Yes. Was Edwin Arden here then?
He was. Mm-hmm. I think I found his lectures very stimulating, but right on the edges of my comprehension. I couldn't really penetrate the language and get at the inspiration, I think. But I think even at that stage I found him very interesting, and later I came to regard him very highly as a creative mind.
So at the end of that year, did you think of staying on at Oxford? Did you stay on at Oxford?
I didn't immediately stay on. Partly, I'd only done one house job, and everyone said, well, you never know what may happen in the world. Get yourself fully qualified, which means doing two house jobs. So I decided to do that. Partly I didn't do terribly well in the exams, so I didn't get an ESRC, or would then have been SSRC scholarship, and so I was quite glad to earn some money by going back to medicine for a year. But I think I was determined to pursue the subject by that point.
So you did some more medicine as a house job, and then you went back, and but you went to SOAS, did you?
No, I came back here for the B-Lit, as B-Lit. It was then called, and spent 18 months concentrating on reading the ethnography on the Himalayas, and that was a very profitable period.
That's when
period.
You wrote your general description of Nepalese.
Yes. You read it, did you?
Yes. It's a wonderful book, a wonderful thesis.
Oh, well.
One of the best things I ever read on before. So I
I quite forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. It helped me enormously, and I pinched ideas indiscriminately from it. Why had you chosen at that point the Himalayas? Was it Needham's influence?
No, it was probably climbing. I'd been reading climbing books, and when I was asked, just as I was going out of the door at the end of a tutorial, have you any regional interests? This must have been about week three or week two of my first term. It just came into my mind to say, well, the Himalayas. I hadn't really thought that far ahead.
You hadn't been there?
No, not at all. I'd been reading a book, I think, called Where Four Worlds Meet by Fosco Maraini, about the Hindu Kush. And Needham immediately said, oh, yes, that's a good idea, and I'll put you in touch with Fiora Heimendorf. Of course, he was, having been a Gurkha himself, was interested in Nepal.
So he put you in touch with Heimendorf, but that was at the end of your B-Lit.
Was it at the end? I think it was earlier. I can't remember at what stage. It may have been during the B-Lit.
And then did you go and see?
I must have.
Christoph?
I can't remember much about early meetings with him, but I must have had them because, as you know, we got that money via Fiora Heimendorf, and so he would surely have interviewed me before giving me money.
This is the Cornell.
Yes.
Cornell project.
Yes.
So remind me.
Actually, was it not was it not SSRC?
There may have been several projects. I was on the London
several.
Cornell.
I see.
To do fieldwork.
Ah.
But that didn't cover my costs to do the course. So maybe it was different.
Ah. Yes. Well, I think mine was SSRC because I eventually wrote a report to the SSRC.
So what happened? Did you go to SOAS?
Yes, about two-thirds of the way through, I think. Yes, the last 6 months of my B-Lit, I started the course in London.
Towards a PhD?
No, it was just the language course.
Oh.
It's true I registered for a PhD at London. Needham was encouraging us to register for two doctorates. He said, you'll collect so much material in the field, you'll have plenty for two doctorates. Why not register for both universities? And at that time, there seemed to be no regulation preventing this. So I was registered for a while at SOAS. But what I mainly did there was take the lessons in Nepali with yourself.
And was it Clark who taught us? I can't remember.
Yes,
had those
and
tapes.
That's right. It was Clark and maybe Barua a bit too. And Lionel and Pat Kaplan were there.
Yes. And so you got to know Christoph a little. He was never...
Yes.
Was he your supervisor?
Yes, officially. Yes, yes.
So you just saw him occasionally?
Yes. When I got back from fieldwork, I was living in London, where my fiancé was at that time. So at that stage, I saw more of him.
You don't say much about him in your reminiscences that you gave to the students. I mean, did you? Was he just a distant figure who you occasionally saw? Do you have any?
Well, of course, I'm very grateful to him for arranging the funding and all that. I don't think he was a very influential figure on my thinking. I think at quite an early stage I'd read Snelgrove's critique of his book on the Sherpas, and having always had these rather philological interests, I sort of didn't feel quite that my orientation was like his. I mean, I was very keen to learn a new language and do a lot of work on the language. I'd always wanted to do that. I wouldn't say he was a deep influence on me, but of course it was helpful to draw on his experience of the country, and he arranged somewhere for me to stay on when I first arrived at the Thyssen Research Centre, that sort of thing. For those sorts of purposes he was very helpful.
Yes. So you finally, how is it that you decided to go to a particular part of Nepal to do your thesis and arise?
I think Feuerheimendorf may well have suggested the Rai in general, and I went off to Nepal not knowing which Rai group. I don't think there was much information available about the different groups apart from their names, and certainly I hadn't laid my hands on it if there was, and I think I met people by chance. I think I must have said to someone, I'm interested in the Rai, and they said, oh, you ought to meet so-and-so, and I met so-and-so, and he said, oh, I know a Tolong Rai, and it must have developed from that.
Did you know fairly firmly what it was that the question was to which you were trying to find the answer?
No. No, I was extremely vague. I knew I was formally obliged to write on social change, because that was, it was under that heading that Heimendorf had got.
Michael York was involved with, I think. It was a big project on social change.
Yes.
SSRC, that's right.
Right.
So you had to study social change, but you weren't sure.
No, and I had no particular questions in mind what I wanted to do, and I felt that the title, the label social change enabled me to do it, was study the most traditional aspects of the tribal culture from a more or less salvage point of view, and I felt you couldn't study change unless you had some idea of the baseline, so that gave me the excuse to work on what I wanted to do, really. Of course, you can't fail to be bombarded at all points with evidence of change in that sort of area. So, although I didn't focus very deliberately on questions about change, they obviously arose. I mean, the panchayat system had recently come in, schools had recently come in, markets had recently come in, and all of those topics you couldn't fail, just living in the hills, to take an interest in.
Was there, what was your impression of your work? I mean, did you enjoy it, or did it have a great impact on you?
Of course, I was older than quite a few students by this time, having gone through medicine and practiced a bit in hospitals. And I think having practiced being a bit of an outsider in various social milieu, such as medical school, I didn't find being an outsider in a sense particularly difficult. I think for a long time my main worry was that I wasn't discovering anything really interesting. I'd read Pinyed rather carefully, and I'd read most of the literature, well, all the literature I could find on Nepal at that time, and these people seemed to be just like everybody else in Nepal, really, and I was a bit disappointed. And it was only after some time struggling with the language and so on that I began to realize how much mythology was still available. And gradually to the ritual, I began to go to more rituals and see which ones were interesting and locally specific and worth recording. So for a long time my main reaction was, am I discovering anything interesting? So slightly anxious and possibly a bit depressed on and off in that first year. Also, probably half aware that I wasn't doing really very well at the language. I'd got, after all, no training whatever in phonetics, and I'd read one book on how to study an unwritten language, but I really had very little idea what I was doing. And it was only after 12 months that I went back to Kathmandu to, I think, meet, to collect my subsequent, my later wife. But anyway, I went, I encountered Austin Hale of the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and he gave me lots of phonemic surveys, which are actually lying in a corner of the room now. And reading through a few of these, I realized what I'd been doing wrong, and discovered that there were long vowels, which I'd failed to notice in the first year. There was a phonemic difference. I was very naive.
Yes. But were you increasingly enjoying it?
Yes. The last 6 or 8 months were great. Mm. And I was much more confident. I was speaking Nepali fairly easily, and could handle the tapes that I was accumulating. And yes, things were going quite well by that stage.
And you were visited by your future to-be wife?
Yes, yes. Yes, that was very satisfactory and probably good for rapport up to a point.
How long was she there?
I think it was 4 weeks, it was about that. Mm. She had, unfortunately, she'd gone to Pakistan as a VSO during my first year, and she got herself fitted with mountaineering boots, which are unfortunately too tight, and on her walk out to visit me, she took an area the size of about 3 postage stamps off the back of both heels and had to complete the journey in flip-flops. But so we were offered treatment by the local shamans, which was nice.
Very effective, I'm sure. Anyway, the Nepal fieldwork will probably be covered a bit more later, but you then came back to write up with Rodney, is that right?
Was he still here? I had... No, at this point Ravi Jain had become the lecturer in Indian sociology, which I think was still the title of the position, and he was my supervisor, and I didn't see a great deal of him. Then when he went back to India, Maurice Friedman was my supervisor for a while, and I had one very interesting long conversation with him in All Souls, and then he died suddenly, and Needham took over again at the last few months.
Had a very bitty supervision, really.
Yes,
five different people.
Yes. Well, yes, I suppose so, with Führer Heimendorf as well, yes.
Mm. Anyway, you said bitty. Who were your examiners? Remember?
Yes, it was. It was Heimendorf again, and I think it must have been Godfrey Leonhardt. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think they perhaps did it both times. I mean, the B-lit as well.
Yes. So once you'd, about that time, you were now wondering what you were going to do next. Or had you already applied for any jobs?
I was back for... a year and a half, really, before I got my first job, yes.
Mm. Which was at Durham?
Yes. I'd applied for one at Newcastle, but didn't get that, luckily, and then the Durham one came up soon afterwards.
Was there anything at Durham or any person who stuck?
Yes.
Was it long?
He was there from about halfway through my time. I suppose the colleague I felt closest to was David Brooks, who did the religion course. But I wouldn't say any of the colleagues influenced me very much. Mm. I was already sort of fairly clear on the sorts of things I wanted to do, and I was reading a lot of people like MacDonald from Paris. Those are the sort of AW, yes. And they were really the people that were influencing me, I think.
Mm. How long were you at Durham? About
nearly 4 years.
4 years.
And one thing I'm glad I did there was to start a course on anthropology and language. Mm. and although I didn't really have time to go very deep into it, it helped me with writing up my grammar of Zulun.
So that's where you wrote that up?
Yes, I did that as a sort of prolegomenon to the thesis, which used the texts of the myths.
And then you got the call to come to back to Oxford, is that right? You got a, how did that happen?
Yes, well, it was after, I think it was an interregnum after Ravi Jain left, and then they got permission to fill the post and advertised. I wasn't sure that I wanted to come back, having spent so much of my life at Oxford and knowing the personalities and thinking that it might be slightly difficult for an ex-student to make the transition to being a colleague. But just about that time my father died and my mother, who lived not far from Oxford, was left a widow, and it seemed only fair that I should try at least to move back. So I decided to come down, to try to come down, and I got the job.
One of your nervousnesses, I think, must have been how you were going to be accepted by your former teacher and supervisor, Rodney Needham, who is now a professor, presumably.
Yes.
And
yes.
I know it's a difficult subject, but I have nothing to say about how that worked out.
Well, it was a very difficult period. I mean, I could see it was going to be difficult because Needham rather liked his, as I say, his judgments tend to be black and white, and he liked people to be totally pro him, and not to pick and choose, not to have a nuanced view. And there were certain parts of his work that even at this time I thought were mistaken or misconceived. And although I thought I would perhaps manage to keep these relatively quiet, I could see it could be embarrassing. And it turned out to be even worse than I'd feared, actually. And the first four terms were very, very difficult, because after the first term he became professor, and then there was a period of growing tension between him and other members of the staff, which made for a very difficult atmosphere, and very difficult for a new member of staff to know how to fit in and what side to take and what was proper procedure and so on.
And it was made even more difficult, so you were made secretary, weren't you, of the department at some point?
Yes, yes. Well, it was a sort of dog's body job. At that time we didn't have very formal administrative procedures, but it was so obvious that we needed a departmental discussion, and I was made secretary as the junior most member of staff, and it was a difficult meeting to do with. Could the professor dismiss an administrator that he didn't approve of? And I kept the minutes for this, and the minutes were eventually sent to the proctors, who wrote back and said that rather laconically, they said quite briefly that although it had been customary for the professor of social anthropology at Oxford to be head of department, it was nowhere stated in the statutes that this had to be the case. And after this letter had arrived, Needham left the department, and a new regime was set up which made life much easier. Probably for him too, and certainly for the rest of us.
Was a new professor appointed?
No, we had a management committee, and Edwin Ardner was the first chairman, and then after him we all took it in turns to do our stint. I did one in the late 80s for a couple of years.
What was your sort of main teaching area? Indian studies and myths?
Yes, I always taught an option in social anthropology of South Asia, and I tried not to make it too Himalayas focused, because quite often we got students who were interested in other areas of the subcontinent. So I gradually moved from being a Himalayan specialist to thinking more generally about Hinduism. And the course was from an early, I think right from the start, was oriented towards Hinduism more generally. And I was making a lot of use of Dumont in my teaching. And of course, otherwise I would just teach the whole of anthropology in the way that one does in a master's course. And this gave me a very good opportunity to enlarge my interests a bit and actually read some economic anthropology at last and become just slightly acquainted with Marxist ideas and so on.
And you didn't ever go back for sustained fieldwork in Nepal?
No. I lost my sabbatical entitlement on leaving Durham. Of course, nowadays one would bargain to retain that, but we didn't do that sort of thing, at least I didn't. In those days, I don't think it was the done thing. So it was quite a long time before I had any substantial sabbatical entitlement. And I decided that as my teaching was now oriented to India in general, I was being a bit marginalized or feeling myself a bit marginalized as a Nepal specialist. So I wanted to work in India. And so I transferred fieldwork interests to the Western Himalayas. I'd hoped to go to the east, to somewhere around Assam, but it wasn't practical because of the political problems in that area. So I went in the early 80s for about 8 or 9 months of fieldwork in Himachal Pradesh, which was very instructive, very enjoyable, great for the family, but not terribly satisfactory as a fieldwork undertaking. I think that was partly because what I still wanted to do was Tibeto-Burman comparativism, and there just wasn't enough Tibeto-Burman heritage, apart from the language, in the area of the Western Himalayas that I was in. And partly I just wasn't there long enough to get the sort of depth in my data that I would have liked. So I'm afraid I haven't written up a great deal about that second spell of fieldwork.
Then at some point you found another great interest, which I think you're going to pursue in your next few years, and that was the very wide comparative framework for some of the great Frenchmen, in particular Dumézil. When did you first come across this work, and what is its significance?
Well, Needham, as part of this intellectual wide range that he tried to instill in his students, had actually sent me one of Dumézil's books, not one of the best in my view, way back in 65, but I couldn't understand it much at the time. But so he was a figure in my sort of mental universe right from the start. And when I became interested in the mythology of the Tulung Rai, I started reading a little bit about mythology in general, and soon decided that Dumézil's approach to mythology was the one I liked. It contrasts with that of Lévi-Strauss in its awareness of history, its sensitivity to time, and I just find that that is a much more congenial approach to anthropology and awareness of time. And I never really got deep into Lévi-Strauss's Mythologique, and I concentrated instead on Dumézil. Of course, I was at that time thinking of the possibility of constructing Tibeto-Burman comparative mythology as a long-term undertaking when I was in Durham. For various reasons, this came to seem impractical as the years passed, and when I came to Oxford and was having to teach about India in general, I realized that this was too narrow a specialism, really, Tibeto-Burman comparative mythology, and transferred the notion of using language families as a comparative framework. I transferred it from the Tibeto-Burman to the Indo-European field, well, obviously partly because I was already reading Dumézil, partly because of one or two stray hints in Dumont, partly because of Mauss, who was also becoming quite an influence on me. So I gradually built up my collection of Dumézil's books, of which he wrote more than 70, more than 70. It's an astonishing output. But one only really needs about 20, and I've got those now. What's his importance? I think his importance, at least from my point of view, as a South Asianist, is that he potentially, at least, offers us a method for grasping the long-term history of the Sanskritic tradition that goes beyond what the Sanskritists can tell us about, because we know that the Sanskritic tradition comes into India with one branch of the Indo-Iranian speakers, and we know that the Indo-Iranian speakers are just one branch of the Indo-European speakers. And if we can bring to bear this wider perspective, we can hope for quite new views, I think, of the history of South Asia and of the development of Hinduism. So I find that's the sort of inspiration I hope that I get from Dumézil.
And this is what you're going to hope to pursue when you go to India in a month's time, more or less?
Yes, it's a fortnight now. I began learning Sanskrit in 1977 and I've sort of more or less kept it up. But it's not as good as I'd like it to be, and I work a lot on the Mahabharata, and I'm hoping to spend quite a lot of time just solidly, day by day, reading chunks of the Mahabharata. I've also more recently become interested in the biography of the Buddha, which I regard as cognate with, as derived from heroic biographies of the sort I've been interested in when comparing Homer and the Mahabharata. And for that I need to improve my Pali, which isn't very difficult if you know some Sanskrit, but it still needs some work.
Good. Well, we covered fairly quickly, but there's another interview lined up on some of the technical aspects, I think, in the future. But was there anything that I didn't ask you which you felt was...
Well, there's perhaps one other interest I might briefly mention, that is kinship. Way back in when I was doing the B.Lit, I became interested in the kinship systems, particularly the terminologies of the Tibeto-Burman area, because it has such a wide range of terminologies within a single language family. And that immediately raises the question of what sense you can make of these. Can you set up or reconstruct a proto-terminology from which the others derive? And after some years taking an interest in that, I sort of moved on to the even wider question of the history of human kinship terminologies and kinship systems in general. From the earliest times, so that's another interest which I may or may not manage to develop during my retirement, but I certainly, in some sense, I feel I ought to, but in order to do it properly, I'd have to do a lot of work on the history of kinship studies, and my impression is that an awful lot of people have been terribly muddled. And I'm not sure that it would be terribly rewarding to work through the muddles of the past. I know what I think, and I've said what I think. So I'm not so attracted to that particular area as I am to the Indo-European work, where new ideas keep coming up.
Good. Well, my clock tells me we're just coming to the end of the tape. So I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Nick, and wish you a wonderful time in India next year, and I look forward to the next time we talk, perhaps not with a camera between us, but thank you very much, and my best wishes also to Sheila. Thank you very much.
Thank you.